Okay, so we know that there is an obligation of the Yom Naroim, which is, in a sense, more important than all the other obligations. We have an obligation of blowing shofar, and fasting, and living in the sukkah, and taking a lulav and esrog, and the like, but all of those mitzvot, as important as they are, probably even including fasting, if we didn't do them, the yantif is still there. The yantif is still accomplishing something. But when it comes to one mitzvah, it could be the entire Yom Kippur is dependent on it. And that is the obligation. The Mishnah tells us in the end of Maseches Yuma that the kapara of Yom Kippur, the atonement that's going to hopefully come from Yom Kippur, will only come if one is also meratzes chavero, that whatever you've done to someone else, Yom Kippur is not going to be mechaper for, unless you also get that person to express forgiveness. So it's an interesting question what exactly that means, and just in terms of the words. What does it mean Yom Kippur is not mechaper? So some of the mefarshim suggest that it means that when you have an avera ben adam lechavero, so sometimes it's a dual avera, that it has aspects that are both ben adam lechavero and ben adam lemakom. And God says, I'm not going to be mochel my part until the human victim is mochel his part. Now, others say it's really true about everything. Pri Chadash quotes this idea from Shmuel Germazian that by definition, every avera ben adam lechavero is really also an avera ben adam lemakom, because God said not to do it. So if you steal, if you speak lashon hara, if you punch somebody in the nose, so not only are you impinging on this person, but you're also going against the mitzvahs of the Torah. So therefore, it's by definition a ben adam lemakom as well. And God says again, we're partners in this. So I'm not going to release my part until the other person, the human victim, is mochel his part. But there are a few who go even further than that. Vilna Gaon, for example, had an understanding, which is very striking, that he maintained that Yom Kippur is not mechaper unless you get mechila from people who you have hurt. It's not mechaper at all. That the whole Yom Kippur doesn't take effect unless you get kapara from those who you have hurt. So that's quite a striking idea. Why should that be true? Why should it be that not only these individual averas are still going to be on your record unless you ask for mechila, but even more than that, Yom Kippur as a whole is not going to take effect. That's a very striking idea. So we have to try to understand a little bit why that is. And we also have to try to understand what the chiyuv barkashas mechila is for. What exactly is the thrust of this obligation? Now, on the surface, you might feel, and it might be assumed, that this is, you find a parallel in civil law, that sometimes a person who has been hurt has the option whether or not to press charges. And that maybe the Torah is saying, and the Gemara is telling us, that your victim can press charges, and that can hold up your kapara. That the police will let you go if your victim decides not to press charges, and God will let you go if the victim decides not to press charges, but you need his waiver. So that might be the case. If that's true, it's interesting. First of all, it's interesting the overall relationship of this to Yom Kippur specifically. One might think, and it may be the case, that if you have somebody who has a grievance against you, so maybe you really have to try to address that as soon as possible. It shouldn't necessarily wait till Yom Kippur. But separate from that, if it's really that it's about getting him to drop charges, so what would happen if this person drops charges without your asking? If, let's say, the person is mochel, without your actually seeking the mechila. So should that be effective? Let's say you happen to know the guy takes out an ad in the paper that he forgives you, or he forgives anyone who's done anything to him. He gives an interview, and he writes that he's mochel. So is that effective? So on one level, you might think it is, but a number of poskim write, there's a tshuva about this, and the tshuva says nidbru. Many others have discussions about this, that it seems to be that you have to actually go through the process of asking mechila. They point out, for example, there's a story the Gemara has in Yuma on Daf Pei Zayin. It was on the Marmar Kolmos this morning, that Rav was offended by a certain butcher, and Yom Kippur was approaching, and he was waiting for this guy to ask for a mechila. And because it wasn't forthcoming, so he tried to make himself available to make it easier for this person to ask for mechila. Reb Yitzchak Petterberger, who was one of the great Talmidim, Reb Yisrael Salanter, was a Talmud in learning and a Talmud in Musar. So he wrote the Sefer Shailos and Tshuvos Pri Yitzchak, a very important halacha sefer. And he also wrote the Sefer Koch Ve'or, so Musar Sefer. So in the Koch Ve'or, he writes that when Rav did this, when he made himself available, in a sense, that was imitating God. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does during the Aseret Yemei Teshuva. Because the Gemara tells us, Dirshu Hashem Bihi Matzo, that we should seek out God when He's close. It says the Gemara, Eilu Aseret Hayamim Shebein Rosh Hashanah Yom HaKippurim, that Aseret Yemei Teshuva is a time when God makes Himself more available, so to speak, so that we should have an easier time asking for Mechila. But maybe human beings do this also. So Rav was making himself available so that he could more easily grant mechila when it was asked. So a number of the posts can ask, well, why do you have to do that then? So it seems like he's ready to be mochel. So why didn't he just send out a memo and mochel this guy? Why does he have to exert himself to make himself available for this person to ask him? So it seems that there is a need to go through the process, that the mechila involves not just the granting of the mechila, but also that the request take place. And that's something the poskim address. So, for example, there is a practice nowadays, which is a highly recommended practice, the Chaya Adam, composed at tefillah, which if you have time, an Erev Yom Kippur, right before Yom Kippur starts, it's worthwhile saying, the tefillah zaka. And in the tefillah zaka, among other things, so you say that you forgive anyone who has offended you. If they owe you money, you still want the money, you're not mochel on that. But on the offense, you'll be mochel on the offense. So maybe you should choose your victims carefully. If you're going to give people a hard time, maybe you try to figure out in advance who says the tefillah zaka on Erev Yom Kippur, and you'll save yourself time asking for mechila. Or the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, this was Daf Yomi not so long ago, that Reb Zeira, when he used to go to sleep every night, part of Kriya Shema Lamita, he would say, Sharlan, I forgive anyone who's done anything to me. So Reb Zeira maybe also is making himself an easy target, because if you're going to bully someone, so you'll bully him, you know, you'll save time on the Mechila. So does that work? So many poskim thought it doesn't. Many poskim thought that was the message of this story, and maybe other indications as well, that it's not only that you need to have the charges dropped, but to go through the process, that seems to be a crucial part of what's going on. Hi.
Are there two parts to have, like, to the mechila process, meaning that basically kind of what you're getting to, like, do you have to, the person who was offended, that granting forgiveness, is that part of the process, meaning that?
Yes, so theoretically it is. We'll get to that, just to what extent that's the case. But yes, the Mishnah and later sources emphasize a chiyuv on his part as well. We'll try to flesh that out a little bit, how that fits into it. So, but first, before we get up to him, so what about asking?
So maybe that only solves that part.
Oh, so solves the charges part.
Right.
Right. Maybe not, actually. There might be more to it. So let's try to see a little bit. So one step that, if we want to say there's more to it than just getting the charges dropped, so one element that you also see seems to be that something about the process is required and beneficial. Now, they say a joke about yeshiva guys, that yeshiva guys, they know that when you put sugar in the coffee, it makes the coffee sweeter. But they're not sure whether it's the sugar that makes the coffee sweeter, or maybe it's the stirring. And just the sugar is there, so you'll know when you've stirred enough. That when it dissolves, then you know that you've done enough stirring of the coffee. So that's a joke, but it could be that that's relevant here as well. It could be that you could ask a similar question. That when we say there's a chi of mechila, bakashas mechila rather, so do we mean that it's all about the mechila? Or maybe it's the stirring. Maybe there's something in the process that really is the focus of what's going on.
Kiva? When I remained in high school, I actually compiled an introduction to various methods of oneness based on that joke.
On that joke, yeah. Is it published?
Yeah, if he has it online, I can send it.
Please do. Okay, so I'll have to incorporate it. Okay. So it's an important joke because it's it reflects a little bit here on this question of are we interested in.
The risk of death is that there are two teabags in each one. Yeah.
So it's an important question sometimes. So here it might be a very relevant issue. What exactly is our focus? Our focus, what's happening? Our focus going through this process in order to make it happen? So why would it be that the process is important? So there are those who suggest that it sounds a little bit funny, but that maybe we want you to embarrass yourself a little bit, that maybe this process of submission is a crucial part of what the Mishnah is asking for, and that's itself a step in tshuva. So the Gemara says in Masechet Brachos, we had a chance to see this also on Daf Yud Beis, Gemara says that Kol Ha'osa Avera U'Misbayesh, that if somebody commits an Avera, and he's embarrassed about it. Mochlin lo. Okay, so far so good. So he's embarrassed for the sin. He deserves to be forgiven. The surprising part is the next part of the sentence. Mochlin lo al kol avonosa. He's forgiven for everything. So that's too much. Why should you be forgiven for everything? Okay, so you're embarrassed about this aveira. So this is a undoing of that. But that you should be forgiven for everything. So some suggest Shlomo Worman's different type of rock has a piece about this and see if Oris Meharachimim that the idea is the very process of embarrassment is itself a reversal of character or something that means that your prior self-confidence and gaiva, which may have been a little bit of a trip up, so now that's turned around. And that itself is a aspect of tshuva holistically, all over, not just on this one aveira. So perhaps the idea is that in order to really get a kapara, even in a specific sense, for what you've done to this person, it's not simply about asking for mechila, but it's on getting mechila, but it's about going through the process. And therefore, the stirring muscle may actually be very valuable, that it could be that it's not so much about getting the mechila at all, really, but that the mechila is like when the sugar dissolves, the mechila is the indication that if the guy forgives you, so then maybe that means you've gone through enough of a process in order to achieve what needs to be achieved. And that could be why we find in the Shulchan Aruch this ruling, which in other areas of life would be very hard to explain, that the Shulchan Aruch records the idea that when you ask mechila, if the person says no, relates a little bit to what you're asking about his obligation. So if the person says no, so then you ask a second time, you ask a third time, and if you still get a no, then you're off the hook. So if it's about obtaining something, so this would not work in any other area of life, right? Can you imagine, so you want to borrow the car keys, and your father says no. So if you ask him three times, all of a sudden it becomes a yes. Right? Normally that's not how it works. And normally that tends to get the yes farther away when you keep asking repeatedly. So where else in life do you find this idea that if you get a no three times, it turns into a yes? So it seems like it's not only about the yes, it's not only about what you are obtaining, but there's something more to it, that the process is meant to be a process of submission, and if you're able to go through that, so then that's an aspect of tshuva, even if it doesn't result in the person saying what you need them to say. Hi.
So the details of that, one of the requirements is to bring along three of his friends?
There is such a discussion as well. Even without that, that's not the part to focus on here. There's different ways of addressing that part, but what is important in terms of the details is that we're not talking about what you do in elementary school and people look at the impression and says, Mokhmi, okay, it's your problem. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about three separate occasions, each time with a different attempt, each time with a different effort, so that you can say, all right, this is a real process to try to get forgiveness, and if it doesn't work, okay, so then at least you've gone through this process, and at least that's something.
Is there such a thing as an unforgivable action?
Yes, there probably is. We'll get to that also a little bit more when we come back to Ben's question about
it.
Right, so the Rishonim mentions that, Mordechai mentions that, right? The Ramah quotes that there is such an idea. We'll come back to that. We'll get to the question of the obligation to be mochel that Ben asked about. Hi.
We said that the fact that no can turn into a yes is an indication that the process is what's important. Mm-hmm. And yet for his Rebbe, he has to keep on asking Mechila, and there's no end, it seems to it. So
right.
Why would that be if the point is not the achieving of the Mechila?
Seems to me that it requires an even greater process, and that the aspect of Kvoharav kind of extends to the nature of what's going on, so it enters into a different realm, not into the normal tshuva, but as part of how it gets complicated by the covenant for the Rebbe that has to be aligned, realigned, has to be strengthened. But in general, normal ben adam v'chaveiro, so to whatever extent you were inappropriately misguided on this person, you were too arrogant in your dealings, so hopefully this should undo it. You also find a couple of other ideas that seem to relate to this. For example, there is a discussion. I remember seeing a few years ago in one of the Jewish papers they had on the front page a question of, could you ask Mechila through email? So that's a way of making things current, but it's not really a new shaila. This is a shaila the postman talked about many centuries earlier, not necessarily about email, but even just about letters. So the question of if you can ask Mechila through a letter, or if you can ask Mechila through an intermediary, that if you have somebody else get in between to ask for Mechila, is that also going to accomplish what needs to be accomplished? And here you find that a lot of poskim are not so thrilled about that. They feel like that's not really the full realization of what this chiyuv is about. And I think it's important to emphasize, doesn't mean that it's worse than nothing. It's clearly better than nothing, and it's also sometimes the first step that's needed in order to be able to have a conversation. Sometimes it's too daunting to even engage in this point, so if you send somebody else to break the ice, or if you first send a letter to say what you want to talk about, sometimes that makes it possible. So certainly wouldn't say that it's not worth pursuing that in order to be able to get to this conversation. And we also wouldn't say that it's better than, it's worse than nothing. If you feel your mamish can't have it at all, then this is worthless. I don't think anyone would say either of those things. But you can understand why maybe this is not a full realization of what the obligation involves. And it's interesting, though, to say that maybe email is a little bit different. There is it's a book called Alone Together by Sherry Turkel. She talks about some of the ways in which technology has changed our interactions. And she has an interesting discussion there that she interviewed some girls who say that nowadays when they communicate through text messages and emails, so they find that the apologies that people give don't really rate. They don't really rise to the level of apologies because the whole interaction is so much easier in a sense and so much more casual that they feel like when their friends apologize to them, it's missing a major part of what the apology is meant to be, and the major reason why they're normally forgiving when people apologize seems to not be there. That this sense that, okay, this person came to me and actually expressed their embarrassment and expressed their regret, and I recognize that, therefore I want to forgive you, that when it comes with a text message, it comes too easily, it comes without really so much of an investment, they don't feel like it really accomplishes what they're looking for. And so that's coming from a secular perspective. It really correlates with this exact concern that some of the poskim are talking about, and it's something to think about.
I mean, you could also take a more optimistic view towards this phenomenon by saying that this type of communication allows people to express remorse and regret in a situation in which they otherwise wouldn't have by lowering the barrier to doing so.
Right, which we said before, that we certainly wouldn't say that it's not better than nothing. It's something much better than nothing, and sometimes it's also a valuable first step. So there's no question that as far as those two choices, it's definitely the way to go if either there's no other avenue or this will take you to the next phase. But at the same time, it does seem to be true that the full picture that we're looking for is not really being accomplished in this venue. Lowering the barrier is exactly the point, that maybe the barrier needs to be there.
My point is that you can view the lowering of that barrier both positively and negatively.
Yeah, and I think if it gets you to that next step, or if it provides something that wouldn't otherwise be there, you know, it's like we always have this question with a lot of things in life, that sometimes when things are kind of in between steps, so do they make it more likely that the full thing won't be there, or do they make it more likely that people who don't start at all will at least do something? So that's always a question. So this is another area where we have that. So it seems to be that this doesn't realize the full vision of what this is supposed to be, what the scheme is supposed to be, but it certainly can play a major role, and if that's what it's doing, then it's hard to ignore that that's a valuable step.
Does an initial letter even cushion, because it cushions the blow and you actually have to talk to the person, like, does that take away from the monthly loan at all?
I don't think so necessarily, because I think ultimately, you know, by the time that process is over, so you've had to go through all of these steps. So if it will ultimately make it more effective and more possible, then it's hard to say. Again, it's a little bit of a judgment call, but it's hard to say that that's not something that should be valuable. So you do find this focus on the process in terms of, you know, somewhat of a necessary unpleasantness as a part of it. The Gra also talks about the idea that you find in Midrashim of if somebody can't get machila from the person, let's say, either because they're refusing to be mochel or because they're no longer alive, maybe. So the idea of gathering a minion and making an announcement. So that idea, what is that supposed to accomplish? How's the minion supposed to be mochel you? And so it seems like the idea that you are expressing your regret in front of this group of people. A minion sometimes represents publicity. That's part of the quality of a minion. Some of the Sfarim suggest that the idea of the minion is to represent the Shechina. That's also something. But to the extent that it represents publicity, it's a way of saying that you want to express regret publicly and you want to take on the submission necessary as a part of growth. And therefore, if the individual is not going to be there to be mochel, this is possibly another avenue. It could also explain a statement that Rama has, which I would emphasize, I think, do not try this at home. This isn't something that really is necessarily the best advice practically, but the concept reflects something that the Rama does write, that this is also relevant to Ben's question, that a person should not be achzari, a person shouldn't be cruel and refuse to be mochel when the elements are there. Then he goes on to say that he's allowed to refuse when it's letovas vakej, that when it's for his own good, then it's okay. So what does that mean? How could it be for the person's own good that he not be forgiven? So it seems like what he means is that if the process is not really complete as far as the individual's personal growth, and this will allow the process to be more complete, so then that could be a legitimate approach. Again, I don't think it's really necessarily something we want to put ourselves in that position of trying to decide what the other person needs for his personal tshuvas. I wouldn't recommend this, but what does the concept mean? Concept seems to mean that the process needs to go through a certain point, and that if that point isn't there yet, so then theoretically, and I really emphasize theoretically in this case, theoretically there could be a value to having it go on longer. Hi.
I was going to ask that. About the judge.
Yeah, I wouldn't, as a matter of practical advice, but as a matter of practical advice, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that, but I think just in terms of what the words mean, and how could it be letovah sanimcha, I think that's what that's probably what the words mean. Now, on the other hand, there is, you know, maybe more practically, a right, before we get to the question of when the victim has a right not to mochel at all, but he is entitled to a full process of apology. So if he feels like the individual is not really putting the effort in and is not really expressing what needs to be expressed, so there is a difference between saying, you know, I need the apology to be more complete and I'm refusing to forgive at all. So from the perspective of the victim, we could hear a reason to delay also. But that's not necessarily the same thing as the language he has there that is saying it's for the sinner's own good. But the idea that the process really does need to reach a certain level of quality, maybe from both sides, is something that we can understand. So that's a second idea that we have, that maybe the idea of asking for mechila is to get released. And secondarily, maybe it's also to go through this process that's meant to be some type of, it's meant to be some type of submission. You find, though, another approach, a third approach, which is a very important possibility. And again, it goes to this question also of why it is that we have a focus specifically on Yom Kippur. And if you've heard someone, it would seem like you should ask mechila at any time, you should ask mechila earlier. So why would it be that we connect it specifically to Yom Kippur? So it's interesting, you find in the literature, the Rishonim quote this, that the arguments that are being made in Shamayim on our behalf, on Yom Kippur, when we are standing B'Yom HaDin, so one of the arguments that's made is, look at the Jews, they're so angelic. And just like the angels, they don't eat and drink, so the Jews aren't eating and drinking today, and aren't doing anything else human related. But also, just like the angels who don't have tension and fighting between them, so too the Jews, they also don't have fighting and tension between them. So that sounds quite messianic, and it's hope and halavai that should be the case. But whether or not it really correlates to anything we see, it seems to reflect this idea that there is a goal that we should enter into Yom Kippur as one unit, as in a state of achdus. And to the extent that we're able to do that, the atonement on Yom Kippur is that much more effective. And if that's the case, maybe that's part of the point, that we want to try to erase whatever impediments there are to a sense of achdus and to a sense of being one nation without quarreling. So to whatever extent there are issues, there are barriers, so we want to try to overcome that. And therefore, perhaps the process of asking from the chila is meant to accomplish that. And that's certainly an idea that you find in the Mefarshim as well, that the notion of asking for mechila is meant to bring about that state of shalom, that Yom Kippur should be more effective. The fact that Chassam Sofer writes in his drushes, a fascinating idea, that he said in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, there was less of a need for asking for mechila, because since the Karbanos and the Beis HaMikdash brought us all together already, so we didn't have to work as hard on creating unity in other ways. But nowadays that we're in Galus, and we don't have this unifying element, so the whole notion of asking for mechila becomes a bigger imperative. It's an interesting idea. Hi.
Isn't there an idea that the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was because they couldn't, they were having trouble?
Right, so that's the cause and effect. You see that they nourish each other, so the more we're together, then we have the Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis HaMikdash creates that unity. That's really the same idea, you know, that the erosion of the communal unity in the Sinasinam is what leads to the Beis HaMikdash being taken away. And the more we're together, the more the Beis HaMikdash stays, the more we have this kind of unity, the farther we get from it, and then the corrective is the work on the Chilul.
It seems like the Kabbalists were effective in there.
They're effective as a reflection of that. That they nourish each other, that the Beis HaMikdash is a unifying element, and to the extent that we are able to hold on to that unity, we hold on to the Beis HaMikdash. And to the extent that we are eroding it from within, so then ultimately that aspect of the Beis HaMikdash, which is so central, know, the Maharal understands that's why that Gemara in Gittin, it's not just even about the Jews, you understand, it's about the whole world. Nobody says that the Beis HaMikdash, this Kibesi based Tila Yikarei L'chal Ha'avim, that should be for everyone. So when the Caesar is carbon and is rejected, the Gemara in Gittin, that comes to Bar Kamsa. So he said, well, who needs the space to make this? It's not going to be a place where everyone is connected. So certainly as far as the Jewish people are concerned, they have that kind of synergistic relationship between the Achdus, the Jewish people, and the Beis HaMikdash, and when one is missing, it chips away at the other. So it's also interesting, some point out that really the obligation to ask for Mechila, you really find it in two places in Shas. You find it in Yuma, and you find it in Bava Kamma also. And the language is slightly different. That the Mishnah in Bava Kamma and Perek HaChovel says that you have an obligation if you wound somebody, and we know you have to pay certain restitutions, five things the Torah talks about. And then the Mishnah says also that you have to be Mevakesh Mechila, you have to ask for forgiveness in order to complete the process. And the Mishnah in Yuma that we've been talking about now in terms of Kaparas Yom HaKippurim, so there are the languages Ad Sheh Yiratze Eschaveru, that you have to try to appease your friend, basically. You have to try to make him feel better. So the idea seems to be that not only is there an obligation to get the charges dropped, that's what you read about in Bava Kamma, that you need the victim not to press charges, but you also have to figure out how to make them feel better emotionally. That it's not just about whatever else came along with it, but the bad feelings that are there because of the offense, that's what has to be addressed before you get burned. That's a separate obligation. So we have these two tracks. You have the asking for mechila in terms of don't press charges against me, and you have this need also to reconcile. And that could be reflected also in the fact that some averos you could have one without the other. You could have averos where there is a ability to press charges, but there isn't really any offense. So for example, you could quibble with this, there are many different ways to interpret this, but they point out there's what seems to be a little bit of a contradiction in the Rambam and Mishnah Torah. Now when he talks about if you steal something, so he says if you steal something you have to pay it back and you have to ask for mechila. And if you damage somebody's property, so then you have to pay it back. He doesn't say to ask for mechila. So the question is, why is one pay back and ask for mechila and one just pay back? So there are some who suggest, and again, there are indications you may want to say differently, but some suggest that when you steal something, so it's more of a personal violation, you're taking it from him and using it for yourself. So not only do they lose their money, but they also feel angry about it. So they need to be smoothed over. But when it comes to their property being damaged, which wasn't necessarily done with any personal gain on your part, so then it's really just a question of restitution, and there isn't necessarily an automatic need for mechila. So the notion is that this mechila is not just about committing an offense against somebody, that's true as well, but that it also correlates to the degree of bad feelings. And when there's more bad feelings, so there's more of a need for mechila. When there's less of a bad feeling, there's less of a need of mechila. And it's not exactly necessarily going to be the same for every aver. So we do find, as you asked, that this is, if you want to say that it's about making peace, you want to say that it's about reconciling, so then we could understand why we find that it's a chiyuv not only on the offender, but also on the victim, to be mocha. That the Mishnah says that one should not hold back mechila. And in terms of the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, you find different ways of phrasing it. In some places it sounds like the word is Shalo yehei achzari, you shouldn't be cruel. And in other texts, it makes it sound like it's an avera, not to be mocha. So here, the idea that there's an obligation not just to ask for forgiveness, but to grant it also, it seems to reflect the fact that our goal is not just that you should have the charges against you dropped, but that we want to enter Yom Kippur in a state of shalom, we want to enter Yom Kippur in a state of reconciliation. And that goes both ways. And therefore, you find Rishonim and later Poskim talking about some ways in which you could find the refusal to be mochel as a type of avera. And it's interesting. So, for example, Shulva Sairash talks about that. Let's say if one's parents say, you know, you're in a family feud, you have the Hatfields and the McCoys. So the parent, the Hatfield parents say, you can never be mochel the McCoys. We're in a generational feud with them. You can never give up on this. So do you have to listen to them? Is that kibud av aim? So we know that normally kibud av aim doesn't include to doing averas. If the parents say that you have to do an avera, so you're not supposed to listen to them. So too, this would seem to be included in that. That's a consideration some of the Rishonim have. You also have a question, right?
Sorry, what kind of level of avera is holding back?
Level in terms of is it Nisr Daraisa, Nisr Darabana,
right?
So it's a good question. It seems to be that it's the same, if you want to say like we're saying now, that it's the same as the Chiyuv Bakashas Mechila. So what does that mean? So we have to say that it's part of the process of Tshuva. So Tshuva, I guess, would be on the one hand the Mitzvah Saseh, although that's a little bit disputed also. Maybe we'll talk about that more as we approach Parshas Nitzavim. But really, it's more than that. Even, you know, there's some debate whether tshuva should be counted as a specific mitzvah or not. But either way, it's more of a meta concept. It's what keeps all the averas in place. And that, you know, it's a failure to do tshuva is somewhat of a renewal of the original avera. So here we're saying that it kind of goes in both directions, that the obligation is not just on the avari, but is on the victim as well. Now, the question, it was a good question, that maybe there are things which are beyond that, which are beyond the ability of the victim to forgive. So as Akiva pointed out, you do find that the Mordechai and the Ramah and others talk about Motzi Shemra as an example. Motzi Shemra is considered to be a particularly egregious offense. We'll actually get to that a little bit, I think, in the parsha this week, so maybe we'll say a little bit more about it. It's relevant to the fourth aliyah of Parshas Kisetze and constant synergy search. But so we'll talk about that. But the explanation is, the way it's explained in the Svarim, that essentially it's very hard to undo, because the concern seems to be that maybe there'll be people who heard the original slander and didn't hear the apology. So assuming even if that would be enough, they would just hear the apology. But you could worry that even if they do hear the apology, that the effect of the slander will stick. But however you phrase it, the concern seems to be that it's not possible to, or it's not likely, that you'll undo all the damage, and therefore there's a legitimacy to not being mochel. So you can glean a couple things from there. That first of all, that the process of mechila does require, at least to some extent, undoing the original avera. And that an avera that has a lasting impact that can't be undone, that it's legitimate on behalf of the victim to not be mochel under those circumstances. So if that's true, on the one hand, it's going to be true not just Motzi Shemra, we can certainly think of other examples where there is a lasting effect, and then if it's true about Motzi Shemra, it's probably true about those averas as well, that if it's not possible to undo the damage, so then it's legitimate for the party to say that he's not ready to be mochel, because apparently the mechila as a chiyuv means that when it's really in the past, so then the victim should let go of it, the victim should be mochel. But if it's ongoing, so then it's legitimate not to. Now, then still, as far as I'm saying, that ideally one would be mochel anyway. But of course, it's going to depend. Everything is going to correlate to just how severe the damage. Sometimes a person is so severely hurt that it's not really possible for them to be able to say lovi mochel under those circumstances. And that will unfortunately be the reality. But to whatever extent it's possible for the victim to say, okay, I accept what was offered as enough of a step, then that's also something that can be addressed. And it's interesting that the Gemara talks about the idea that normally if you stole money, right, so you have to return it as part of tshuva. So you can't steal money and then say, I do tshuva and I ask for mechila, but I'm keeping the money. And so that would seem to be self-evident. But what would happen if it's impossible to return the money for whatever reason? Let's say it's an item that doesn't exist and can't be replaced. Or let's say you stole from the public and the public, you can't identify exactly who you stole from, or things that are related to that. So there are a number of implications that it's possible to do tshuva even without that, or even before that. That the status of the individual changes from bad to good even before they actually return the stolen money. So why should that be true? So I think what it indicates is that when we talk about undoing the avera, so it doesn't necessarily mean that tshuva is only effective when the avera is erased. It's not always possible in the real world to erase the effect. Sometimes, unfortunately, there's going to be lingering effects no matter what. But sometimes the relevant question is, are we doing everything we can to erase the effect? Because it's a direct contradiction to say, I stole money from you and I really regret it and I'm really sorry, but I'm keeping the money. If you're keeping the money, then you're not really sorry. But if it's simply not possible for you to return the money, you've done everything that you can, but there's nothing more you can do. So then you're not contradicting it, you're not undermining it with the behavior of holding on to the money. So sometimes that's true of ben adam l'chaveiro as well, or in general ben adam l'chaveiros, that on the one hand, the lasting effect is a reason for the victim sometimes to not be in a place where they can forgive. But also sometimes the issue is not so much that their hurt is continuing, that's true also, but that the tshuva is not genuine. If there's something you could be doing in order to fix it, then you're not. So then that's a deficiency in the tshuva itself. But if you're doing everything you can, there simply isn't more that can be done. So then that deficiency isn't there, and that's also a part of the complex equation. So we find that really we have these two elements to mechila, that mechila is a technical legal requirement that the charges should be dropped, and then there's also more of an interpersonal kind of concept that either it's a submissive process so that you can properly change the mida that got you in trouble in the first place, and it's an act of reconciliation so that you can smooth over, you can actually fix the issues between people, so that that should actually create unity that's necessary for Yom Kippur to be effective. And for that, as Sfarim point out also, that's why also Yom Kippur you find as a target, not just because it needs to be done before Yom Kippur, so that Yom Kippur can be effective, but also sometimes even in the other direction, that sometimes it makes sense to wait, because could commit an offense against someone and it's too fresh for the person to be able to forgive and it needs a longer process. And what the Mishnah says, Al Yargaz Adam B'Shas Kaso, that when a person is very angry, so you're not going to have much success in trying to get them to see past it and you'll likely just cause more problems. So that angle, that aspect of reconciliation might mean that it's not always the best time to do it earlier. Sometimes later is better. And that's a part of the seichel that's required in terms of understanding how exactly to do this. So this is a big question. Do you really see mechila as purely a technical thing, or do you see it more as an emotional reality? And it's probably some combination of both. Just to highlight the technical realities, as I said, for example, that when Saul Salanter had given advice that if you want to know how to be mochel someone, so the moment that they offend you, so you should mochel right away, because then you won't be able to change your mind later. And this is what you find in the monetary realm, that if somebody owes you money, and you say that you're mochel, they don't have to pay, so you can't come back a month later and say, you know what, I actually do need your money. Because once you're mochel, the debt goes away, and you can't get it back. It doesn't come undone. So too, he says, if you're mochel, the offense, then you won't be able to come back and decide you're angry again later, and that's going to be an eitzah to get past things. So that has merit to it. If you see mechila as purely a technicality, you see it purely as I have charges that I can press or I can drop, okay, so once you drop them, you can't pick them up again. But to the extent that there is a emotional reality, so then things can resurface, and if the goal is that we're trying to have a reconciliation between people, so then that really falls for a different focus. And maybe on some level, they're both true. Or similarly, there's a story they say about the Steichler. Maybe you've heard the story that there was a bar mitzvah in Bnei Brak, and the Steichler all of a sudden shows up at the bar mitzvah. And they couldn't figure out what his connection was to anybody, why he show up. And then he explained that whatever, 6 years earlier, he had been in shul in Yom Kippur next to this 7-year-old boy, and he thought the boy was learning instead of davening, so he gave him a speech saying Yom Kippur is a time for davening, not for learning. And he didn't realize that the sitter he was using looked like a gemara, but really was a sitter, so he felt he inappropriately gave him mussar, so he wanted to ask him for mechila. But he assumes cotton can't be mochel, so he waited till he was bar mitzvah, and in the moment he was bar mitzvah, he showed up to ask for mechila. So again, that's coming from a paradigm where mechila is more monetary-like, so maybe a cotton can't be mochel on money, but his hurt feelings presumably can be mochel on. So it's clear that there is a prohibition of anas tavarim by a cotton as well. If you hurt a cotton's feelings, it's easy to forget when you have little children running around. There's a prohibition of anas tavarim by them as well. So there is a need for mechila, but you could make a case that they're able to be mochel on these kind of things. And it's not necessarily comparable to a monetary type of mechila. So presumably there are aspects of both. And that it's kedai to be machmir for both. It's kedai to realize that Yom Kippur asks for us to try to correct both aspects of our interpersonal fractures, and that it may take the entire month of Elul, as we're working on Tshuva this month, to address not only the practical aspects, but also the emotional aspects, and that's sometimes a long-term project, so the earlier we get ready, started and focusing on how to do that as we approach Yom Kippur in the beginning of Elul, hopefully the better off we'll be. There is a major element to this which I left out because it's a long discussion. So maybe we'll pick up on this sometime later in the week or next week. But the question of the unique challenges that are posed by Nechila for Lashon Hara, which is also relevant to this week's parsha, as we'll see. So I mentioned a few minutes ago that Motzi Shemra has a unique challenge, but Lashon Hara in general has a few specific challenges as far as tshuva is concerned. So maybe, again, in the spirit of the Ben Adam Mechavero focus and the Elul focus, maybe we'll find some time in the next few days to come back to that. But let's just quickly review what we spoke about. We spoke about the fact that Mishnah tells us there is an obligation to ask for Mechila, otherwise Yom Kippur is not going to be effective. We saw some say that it's talking about averos that are both Ben Adam Mechavero and Ben Adam Lamakom. Others say that every Aver Ben Adam Mechavero is also Ben Adam Lamakom, and the Gra says that it's about everything. Yom Kippur is not Mechaper for anything unless you ask for Mechila. So we consider the question, is it about getting a release of claims? But if that's the case, then you think that if the person is mochel without your asking, it should also work. And the Gemara about Rav doesn't sound that way. So it doesn't sound like if they say Tulazaka, or if they take out an ad, or if they say Pirishma Lamita with this phrase, any of that necessarily gets you off the hook. So why should that be? So we discussed the possibility that maybe it's about the process, like the stirring of the tea, and stirring the sugar into the coffee. And the idea is you need to go through a certain process in order to get mechila, and maybe that's about submission, that might be what it's about. That could explain the idea that if you ask three times that you are off the hook, even though in any other area of life that wouldn't work, or the idea that Postkin felt that it's preferable not to go through a letter or an intermediary. Again, we emphasize unless that'll either get you to the full step or there's no other way to do it, but that it doesn't seem to represent the whole picture. We'll discuss the idea of apologizing in front of the minion, what that's supposed to accomplish, and all of those related ideas, as well as the Ramah statement that you're allowed to withhold mechila if it's for the good of the offender. And again, we emphasize, don't try that at home, but that's what the concept seems to indicate. And we talked about how maybe it's not necessarily about embarrassment, but it's about reconciliation and the idea that the Shomim quote, that Yom Kippur, we get special attention because we're in a state of Shalom with each other, and halavai that should be true. We talked a little bit about the Chassam Sofer, that the Karbanos once upon a time was a unifying factor. Now we have to look for other ways to be more united. And we talked about the different languages in Baba Kamma and in Yuma, about the Shivakish Mechila and Ashiratzos Mechila, and how sometimes an offense doesn't necessarily bring about such bad feelings. And we talked about the difference between asking for mechila when you steal something and maybe not asking for mechila if you damage something, just paying for it. Why should there be a difference between the two? And then talked about the obligation of the victim to be mochel. He shouldn't be an achsa or he shouldn't be a chote. You know, some of the posts can talk about how maybe you shouldn't listen to parents who say not to be mochel, or maybe you shouldn't, I think you left this part out, you shouldn't, if you take a shvua not to be mochel, then maybe that shvua is not binding, because it's considered to be a shvua against the Torah. That's certainly something that comes up. Sometimes people say they swear they're not going to forgive this person. So that's also a discussion. And we mentioned that there are exceptions that it's brought in the Svarim, that if a person is a victim of Motsi Shemra, he's not necessarily obligated to forgive, although he's encouraged to forgive. We'll consider a little bit what that means about the long-lasting effect. And certainly there are other offenses that have a long-lasting effect. And what exactly does that say about this whole process? We'll talk about that a little bit. And about the question of whether this is really then to be viewed as a technicality or more of an emotional reality, and some of the nafkaminas that that has. Example, the question of can you change your mind about Mechila? We mentioned it. So also Hunter's suggestion that you should mochel immediately so that it's a done deal and you can't come back to it. And that works more with the monetary model than with the emotional model. And also the question of whether a katan can be mochel. We mentioned the story about the stiper that he felt he had to ask for Mechila after this boy was bar mitzvah, which again is more of a monetary model. But we could see both paths being true. And we mentioned this idea that we should try to accommodate both. And we need to spend a lot of time over the course of Elul and the Aser Shmei Shuvah in order to accomplish that. But that's possibly the task, the likely task that we have in front of us. So we'll let you go. We'll have, should have a wonderful day. Should have only positive accomplishments and positive interactions. And I guess we'll pick up on Tuesday.